Okay, so you're test graded. The average score on this exam was lower than the first one. I think first one, I think the average was 89. It meant a lot of people were looking doing really well in the course. On this exam, the second exam, the average was 84. So there was a bit of a drop, but everyone is still doing relatively well. I do want to give you one statistic that is really striking. I told you that definitions would appear on the exam, and I told you exactly the four definitions that you'd be required to know. As it turned out, the students who actually got all the definitions right, that had succeeded in memorizing them at least, their average score was 97%. So, I mean, and that's part of the reason why I've always insisted on definitions, because it's not just knowing the words, but it's kind of hard to memorize without having a little bit of understanding as well. And it really helps you when you're asked to find a basis for a subspace to know what you're looking for. And so those definitions really are a crucial pedagogical tool that I use. And I promise you, on the final exam, those four definitions are going to reappear again. And so if you haven't got the definitions quite memorized yet, I still recommend you do so because they are going to appear again on the final exam. Okay, so that said, let me pass back the exams. Abdullah, not here. Mohammed, Joseph Brett Bem, Hussein, Yusuf Dalati, Manny DeLeon, Matthew Griffin, Cameron Killinger. Oh, sorry. I'm looking at the wrong exam. Here we go. These are the ones I want.
Matthew's in our section, are you?
Well, actually, that was the first exam. And he's going to have to pick it up himself. I'm not allowed to distribute exams to friends and the like. All right, let me try again. Cube's not here. David Calvert. Jackson Casillo. Peyton Dayer. Oh, so I'm still got the wrong exams. I'm sorry, I must have left them the correct exams in my office. Hold on, I'm just down the hall. Okay, here we go. Paul Aldridge, Abdullah Alford, Mohammed Alcaraz, Joseph Bem, Hussein Muhammad, Yosef Dalati. All right, here we go. Some new ones. Tristan Fisher. Carly Gotchner. Matthew Griffin. Noah Hightower. Yuwang Wang, last name spelled H-W-A-N-G, Cameron Killinger, Zhang Li, Josh Lindholm, Mika McCombs, Grace Potts, Preston Stout, Grant Swallow, Kyle Treyer, Robert Triplett, Dawson Walker. All right, anyone not get, yeah, what's your name? Last name starts with, yeah, oh, that's it. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that the wrong one?
Billy
J-H-A-O. I'm not missing it. It's in, the last name starts with a
J. J.
With a J?
Last name is J-H-A-O.
J-H.
J. Z.
Oh, Z. Z. Okay, very end then. Ah. Yeah. I've got a score for you. Maybe it got tangled up with other exams. Here, let me, I think I have all my exams here. I've seen to have misplaced your exam, but I'll bring it. It's probably sitting on my desk somewhere. But if you want to see your score, you got, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You did very well. I'll bring it next time. Okay, so I've posted the solutions to the exam. They're up on Canvas. And so what I suggest you do, if you have questions about how things were graded, first look at the solutions and you see how the sort of answer I was expected. But sometimes I make mistakes in grading, particularly if you row reduce something to row echelon form. There's so many different versions of a matrix in row echelon form that I may not have recognized your solution as being correct. So, but if it is, if it's a bona fide row echelon form of the given matrix, I'm happy to correct that. But most of the mistakes actually were fairly simple. You calculate a matrix wrong because you don't remember to write things vertically rather than horizontally, or you calculate the row space of a matrix instead of the column space of a matrix, et cetera. But if you do have questions on how the exam is graded, I'll be happy to address them. But do have a look at the solutions first so we can, hopefully the solutions will answer most of your questions. And if not, I can make adjustments. All right. Let's. Yep, that's working. Okay. Okay, so what I want to do today is I want to make a little bit more progress on determinants. I'll start off by reviewing what we covered last time, what determinants do for us, and some two different formulas for computing the determinants of an n by n matrix. But as we've seen on Wednesday's lecture, while determinants are fairly easy for small matrices, if matrices get moderately large, like 4x4 or beyond, they get really complicated really, really fast. They're typically a polynomial in the entries of a matrix. But if you have like a 6x6 matrix, if you actually want the determinant of a general 6x6 matrix, it's going to be a polynomial of degree 6 with 720 separate terms. So these determinants, in some ways, are a simple polynomial function, but in practice, they can be really strenuous to compute. And so I'll go over the definitions of what the determinant is, but the main point of today's lecture is to give you a simpler way of calculating determinants that doesn't require you to work directly from the definitions. Rather, what we'll learn how to do today is how to reproduce a matrix and get the determinant of a matrix very quickly that way. Okay, so what's a determinant? If you have a square matrix, so the same number of rows as you have columns, the determinant is supposed to be a function of the entries of that matrix, such that if that function is equal to zero upon evaluation, then you can conclude many things. So I'll state this in the negative. If the determinant is equal to zero, that means the matrix does not have an inverse. And that also means that you have multiple solutions to any linear system where you use the given matrix as a coefficient matrix. And it also is going to imply that if you have this particular linear system where the coefficient matrix times a variable is equal to zero, that you're going to have more than just that trivial solution where you set x equals zero. This will be an important consideration next week when we start considering eigenvectors and eigenvalues. It also means that A is not row reducible to the identity matrix, or that the dimension of the row space, the dimension of the column space, or equivalently the rank of a matrix, that's less than the number of rows and the number of columns of the matrix. Now, I've stated these things all in sort of a negative way, that inverse does not exist, or we have more than one solution. The fundamental theorem of linear algebra is actually the negation of each of these statements. What we proved just after the first exam is that if a matrix has an inverse, then you only have one solution of such linear systems. In fact, this linear system has only the solution x equals zero, and A is row reducible to the identity matrix if the inverse exists, and the rank of A is equal to n if the inverse exists. So the fundamental theorem of linear algebra that we stated, the fundamental theorem of invertible matrices, each of these statements is negated, but they're all equivalent to one another. That's just so I can take this one condition, determinant A not equal to zero, and directly draw these conclusions. But on the other hand, if the determinant A is not equal to zero, then the negations of all these statements occur. But we're actually going to be interested in this case when, for the most part, whether the determinant of A is equal to zero, because that's going to tell us something about solutions of equations like this. So it's going to be a polynomial function. So as soon as you have concrete entries of A, then you'll be able to compute this and decide whether the number that results by evaluating that polynomial is zero or non-zero. All right, so let me give you the formulas for small matrices. If you have a matrix with one row and one column, then its determinant is just its one entry. Notice that this is a linear function. In fact, it's just the variable, and it occurs to the first power, and there's only one term there. We have a 2x2 matrix, So now we have two rows and two columns. The determinant turns out to be the difference of the diagonal products. You multiply down this diagonal, and then you multiply against down the cross diagonal, switching the sign. And this is a polynomial. See, each term has two variables as factors. And it's just a polynomial in the entries of the matrix. More generally, let me give you a sort of visual formula that you can also apply for a 3x3 matrices. I only did this for 2x2 matrices because these two formulas are pretty easy to remember. But if you had a 3x3 matrix, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, there's a sort of visual way of getting the formula for the determinant of this matrix, sort of like this. It mimics this calculation. What you do is you write the first two columns, you write them again off to this side. And then what you do is you take these diagonal products. So if this is A, then the determinant of A is going to equal A times E times I, and then B times F times G, plus C times D times H. And then we're also going to have some, just list here, we have these diagonals from the upper right to the lower left. Those are going to come in with a minus sign. So I'll have B, D, I minus A, F, H. Sorry, A, F, H. And then C, D, G. C. So there is a sort of visual formula for the determinant of a 3x3 matrix as well. You get that by writing the first two columns again off to the right of the original matrix and just taking diagonal products. But for 4x4 matrices and beyond, there is no such simple visual rule for calculating the determinants. What we rely on instead then is a recursive formula for the determinant. So more generally, if you have a larger matrix, an n by n matrix, the way you calculate the determinant is by calculating the determinants in terms of the minors of the matrix. Now, what these minors are, this is going to be, if this is an n by n matrix, this minor attached to A, it's actually indexed by a row index and a column index of the original matrix A. And what it is, it's the matrix reformed from A by removing from A its ith row and jth column. So we take away one row and we take away one column, we get an n minus 1 by n minus 1 matrix. If we, but this gives us a rule that allows us to calculate the determinant of an n by n matrix as a sum of determinants of smaller matrices. It's going to be basically one less row dimension and one less column dimension than the original matrix. Now, if you don't know precisely what this determinant is, you could apply this formula again, take this n minus 1 by n minus 1 matrix, apply a similar formula, and reduce the calculation of this thing into a sum of n minus 2 by n minus 2. And then keep applying this formula over and over again until eventually you get down to a determinant of, say, a 2x2, where you have an explicit formula for doing the computation. So let me show you an example of that. Here's a general 3x3 matrix. Applying that cofactor expansion along this first row, what I'll do is I'll march across the first row and I'll grab a term for each entry in that row. Those terms consist of the entry in the slot. Then you have a sign factor that you get by adding the row and column index of the particular entry. If that sum is an even number, then this will be a factor of 1. But if I plus J adds up to an odd number, we'll have negative 1 to an odd power, which will be minus 1. So here's how this will work out. If I march across the first row, I have the first entry. And then let me put that formula up. basically a sum, and then you have the entry, and then you have a sign factor, and then you have a determinant of a matrix I get from the original matrix by removing its ith row and jth column. And then here you can sum. In this case, let's sum over j. J equals 1 to n. And then here I is fixed. Fixed row index. And that gives us, actually, I have a different formula depending on which row I want to use. But if I use the first row, then I grab an element of the row. There it is. I get the sign by adding up, adding the row index and column index and raising minus 1 to that power. So for this guy, 1 plus 1 is 2. Minus 1 to the squared is equal to 1. So I don't get any switch in sign here. And then I have the determinant of the minor, which I get by, here's the entry we're looking at. We remove the row and column that contains it, and we're left with this 2 by 2 minor, A22, A23, A32, A33. All right, and that's just the first term. Then I go to the second term in that row. I pick up a minus sign because 1 plus 2 adds up to 3, which is an odd number, and so minus 1 to the third power is going to be negative 1. So I get the entry, the sign factor, and then the determinant of the matrix I get by eliminating the row and column that contains the 1-2 entry. And then I have the contribution for the third element in the row. And similar construction. There's the entry. There's the sign factor works out to be 1 because 1 plus 3 adds up to an even number 4. And then here's the corresponding minor. And then I've reduced the computation of a determinant of a 3 by 3 to adding up a bunch of determinants of 2 by 2 matrices. But here we'll just use the cross diagonal product formula to compute those determinants. You get this. And now you see explicitly the polynomial in the entries of the original matrix that that corresponds to the determinant. Notice that you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have a total of 6 terms. 6 happens to equal 3 factorial. And this turns out to be a general property of determinants. When you take the determinant of a n by n matrix, the number, you'll get a polynomial, but the number of terms in that polynomial is going to be n factorial. So if you had a 4 by 4 matrix, you'd have 24 terms. If you had a 5 by 5 matrix, you would end up with 120 terms. And you see already this is getting quickly outrageous, even for matrices of moderate size. If you had a 6 by 6 matrix, you would have 720 terms in the polynomial expression for the determinant. So, the upshot of this is that while for 2 by 2 matrices, they're really simple to compute, even for 3 by 3, you only have 6 terms. But when you start getting beyond with looking at matrices that are 4 by 4, 5 by 5, or 6 by 6, these determinants become complicated functions to compute. I mean, they just have a tremendous number of terms. And you probably don't have the stamina to compute the general determinant of a 6 by 6 matrix. Rather, what you'll do, it's not like you'll be able to avoid 6 by 6 matrices for the rest of your life. Rather, what you'll do is if you have to take the determinants of a 6 by 6 matrix, you'll go out and you'll spend far less time going to the library and figuring out what computer program will actually compute this for me. And in fact, that's one of the standard things. Every mathematical software program, you will have a way of computing determinants fairly rapidly. All right, but we want to understand determinants a little bit better. So the other thing I did on Wednesday, besides giving you this recursive formula that allows you to compute determinants by breaking it down into small determinants of smaller and smaller matrices. There's another way of writing down an explicit expression for the determinant of the matrix that's equally hard to compute, but at least it visually, it tells you a little bit more about what the determinant is. Here's the formula. It involves the idea of permutation of the numbers between 1 and n for an n by n matrix. Now, what a permutation is, it's just you take the numbers between 1 and n and you write them in a different order. And how many possibilities are there? Suppose I take the numbers 1, 2, 3, up to n, and I now I'm going to consider other things, like maybe 2, 1, 3, dot to n. So this would be another ordering of the same list of numbers. The number of choices you have, so the possible number of permutations you have of this standard list, 1 through n, is, well, for that first slot, you have, the first slot could be any one of these numbers, so you have n choices. In the second slot, in this slot here, you've used up one of your choices when you filled in the first slot. So the numbers that you have left is going to be a total of n minus one choices for that second slot. And then when you move to the third element, you've used up two numbers out of this list, so you'll have n minus two choices left. And you keep doing that until you get to the last slot. But that last slot there, you've used up n minus one of these numbers, so there'll be a unique number left from the original list that you can put in that last slot. So that will be one. And now to count the total number of possibilities, you just count up the number of choices. You have n choices here, n minus one choices here, n minus two choices here. These multiply together to give you the total number of choices. So in the end, you have n factorial. You just, the product of all the integers between one, n and one choices total. So, in this formula here, when I sum over permutations, I could be summing over a large number of permutations. It's going to be exactly n factorial. That's how I was getting these numbers, like a polynomial for a 6x6 matrix, the number of terms is going to be 6 factorial, which is 720. That's where it's actually from this formula that I was pulling, identifying the number of terms. The other thing to notice about this formula is these are the entries of the matrix. The way I've written this term here is the row indexes are occurring in their natural order. 1, 2, the next factor would be A3 something until I reach AN factor. So there are exactly N factors here. That means this term is a degree N term because there are N variables in that term. But besides that, I just have a sign factor that's going to be plus or minus one. If you look at these factors here, the way I construct it is I have each factor here lives in a different row, but also each factor lives in a different column because these numbers sigma 1 through sigma n are just a rearrangement of the numbers 1 through n. So each of these numbers is distinct. You don't have two twos or one two threes or anything. Each number here is distinct. And so effectively what these factors here represent is a product of entries of the matrix where the product constructed by taking from each row and from each column a unique element. And so you take a unique element in the first row, a unique element in the second row, a unique element in the third row, but they also have to live in separate columns as well. And what you end up summing over is all the possibilities, all the ways you can create factors like this by choosing elements that live in different rows and in different columns. All right, and then from that form of this polynomial, Oh, yeah, to get the sign, that's a bit tricky. What you have to do for a given ordering of the numbers between 1 and n, you have to count the number of times these numbers appear out of order. Let me give you an example of that. Let's calculate the sine of the permutation 3, 1, 2. All right, now the way I get this this sine is I count the number of times pairs of entries in this list appear out of order. So 3 should not be appearing before 1 because 1 is less than 3. So that's out of order. This is in order. So this is not in order. This pair is in order, 1, 2, but 3 and 2 are out of order. So so the number of times in this list, the number of times the entries are out of order are 1 and 2. And so that's going to be minus 1 to the 2 equals 1. If I had had sine 3, 2, 1, that's the ordering. Now every pair is out of order. This is out of order. 2 precedes 1. Well, that's out of order. And then 3, it does not come before 1, so that's out of order too. And so in this case, we would get minus 1 to the third. All right, so I'm just did a couple of these sine computations. So you see that it's not something you can, you actually have to write out a permutation and then stare at it a little bit to figure out exactly what the sine of this is. But you can kind of work it out as the way I did here. You can work out what that sine is. And fortunately, it is very little information. It's just a plus one or minus one, but it's kind of tedious to figure it out for any particular permutation. But if you have figured out all these signs, then these just turn out to be factors plus or minus one. And then what the formula then shows you is that the determinant of a n by n matrix is a polynomial of degree n, because you'll have n factors in the variables, and each term has exactly n factors, and that the number of terms that occurs is going to equal the number of permutations, which is going to be n factorial. Okay, so the upshot of this is I'm not giving you a formula that's any more efficient for computing the determinant, but at least it's revealing sort of its functional structure. It makes it pretty explicit, except for the signs and except for explicitly figuring out how many different ways you can order the numbers 1 through n. All right, but we're not going to rely on that. Rather, what I want to do is I want to show you a simpler way of computing determinants that doesn't require you to sum up, for example, 720 separate terms in a polynomial. All right, now that's going to come about because if a matrix has a relatively simple form, then its determinant is going to be really trivial to compute. The form I want to describe to you now is upper triangular matrices. So these are matrices. These are only, let me say it this way, entries are only non-zero when the row index is greater than the column index. Effectively, what that's going to mean, along this diagonal here from the upper corner where you have A11, lower corner you have A and N, in the second slot here you have A22. Along this diagonal, the row index and the column index are exactly the same. To be upper triangular, We're simply demanding that below this main diagonal, we only have zeros. That's kind of like row echelon form, but it doesn't actually have to be in row echelon form. What I'm really demanding is I scan the matrix, I look along the from the upper left corner to the lower right corner, and I just ask, are the entries below that diagonal all zero? If so, we say the matrix is upper triangular. Let me give you, so here's the condition. When the column index is less than the row index, I want the matrix to be zero. Here's a matrix. So look at this guy. It's equal to zero. This is an upper triangular. Here's the main diagonal. And below it, you have nothing but zeros. But the reason why this guy is zero is because the row index is two, but the column index is one. Since one is less than two, we have to put a zero there. And similarly for these other guys. But I think visually, just look at the matrix, look at that main diagonal. And if you, after you put a ruler or something over those diagonal entries, if you only have zeros off to the lower left, then you have an upper triangular matrix. Notice this matrix is upper triangular, but it's not row echelon form. Right, because here I have a pivot sitting directly below a pivot. So it is not true that upper triangular matrices are always in row echelon form, but the opposite is true. Anytime you have a matrix in row echelon form, it's automatically in it's automatically upper triangular. What that tells you is if I start off with a matrix that's not upper triangular, I can perform row operations that will transform it into a matrix in row echelon form, and then I'll have a matrix that's upper triangular. So even if I started off with a matrix that was not upper triangular, I could make it upper triangular by just using our usual row reduction algorithm. I just have to take it to row echelon form, and I'm guaranteed that it's automatically upper triangular. But to calculate the determinant of this guy, it's going to be really, really simple. I'll show you why. It's going to turn out that the determinant of this matrix, it's a 4x4 matrix. I should expect 24 different terms to calculate the determinant. But in fact, I can tell you right now, just looking at it, the determinant of this matrix is 6. What I'm doing here is it's actually 0. I'm multiplying along this main diagonal. 3 times 0 times 2 times 1 would equal 0 because they have a factor of 0. All right, so let me restate that as a theorem. If you have an upper triangular matrix, then its determinant is just the product of the elements along that main diagonal where the row index of each factor always matches the column index. All right, so I'll prove this for a 4x4 matrix, and then you'll, in the course of the proof, you'll see why it's true in general. Suppose we start off with this general, this is the most general thing I can write down that's 4x4 and is also upper triangular. So to calculate the determinant, I can do a cofactor expansion along this bottom row. So what I'll have, according to my formula, let's keep it up here, determinant of A is going to equal sum over say, I guess I'll sum over columns. I'll have entries I, j, sign factor a minus 1 to the I plus j, and then I have the determinant of the minor that corresponds to that entry. And so this is for a fixed row index I. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use the fourth row of this matrix to start off this cofactor expansion. Well, that I do on this page. So here's the entry. In the first entry in that fourth row was 0. So actually, the first three terms are all going to be 0 because I have 0. I'll have a term like this where this factor is 0, so I won't have to compute the determinant. The second term in that row, the entry in that matrix is also 0, so I won't have to compute that guy. The third entry is 0, but when I reach the last entry, that's the first time the actual entry in the matrix, the actual entry in the row is non-zero. So that leads to this formula. First entry in the row is zero, so I don't even have to compute this determinant. Here, the second entry in that row is zero, so I don't have to compute that matrix, the determinant of that matrix. Third entry is zero, but that fourth entry, that's where we have the non-zero entry, and now I have something that I need to compute, because if this number is not zero, this might not be, that will have a positive contribution to the determinant. Right, so I write that out, and now I have a determinant of another upper triangular matrix. We'll do the same thing. We'll do a cofactor expansion along the bottom row to calculate the determinant of this matrix. So I'll ignore these first three zeros. I have an overall factor of A44, and then I'll do a cofactor expansion of this 3x3 matrix. So I have 0 times minus 1 to the 1 plus 3. So this is in the 1, 3 slot of this matrix. So the sign factor is going to be minus 1 to the 1 plus 3, or simply a factor of 1. And then the corresponding minor for this guy, I eliminate the row and column that contain it. I'm left with this 2x2 matrix, A12, A13, A22, A33. Then I go to the next guy, 0, the sign factor here. Let's see, this is in the third row, second column. 3 plus 2 adds up to 5. So that's minus 1 to an odd number. That's where that minus sign came from. There's the entry itself, and then you have the determinant of the corresponding minor. I don't have to compute this determinant because it's being multiplied by 0. And I'm left with simply this. This is not going to survive. That's not going to survive. So I'll have A44 times A33 times the determinant of this 2x2 matrix. And there I've written out the determinant of that 2x2 matrix by doing another cofactor expansion. And see, the determinants of these 1x1s are just the entries. And when you work it out, this is just the product of the diagonal elements. Now that's going to happen in general. This happened because I did a cofactor expansion. I got this factor, but then I had to compute the determinant of the corresponding minor. It's also upper triangular, so I'll pick up this factor times the determinant of a smaller minor. But it's still upper triangular, so I'll get this factor and I'll get the determinant of a smaller thing. But now we've just a 1x1 matrix, so I just get that entry. Well, that pattern of calculation works no matter how large the original matrix was. You just steadily keep reducing it, and you find that the only thing that survives the calculation are these diagonal elements. All right, so that's great. That means that if you had a 6x6 matrix and you wanted to, you knew it was upper triangular, then its determinant would consist of only one term out of, for a more general 6x6 matrix, you would have 720 different terms. So this is making upper triangular matrices make life really easy, because instead of having n factorial terms to worry about, you only have to worry about those products along the main diagonal. All right. So what I want to show you now is, for most cases, the matrix you're going to be looking at is not going to be upper triangular. And so the technique I've described for computing determinants of upper triangular matrices will not be applicable in general. But we have a way of converting matrices into row echelon form matrices, and those are examples of upper triangular matrices. What I'm going to show you is that it is not true. So A can go to its row echelon form via elementary row operations. And on the other hand, if A prime equals the reduced row echelon form of A, then the determinant of A prime is just going to be equal, well, you have to use the entries of this matrix. I'll put primes over my entries, but it's just going to be the product of the diagonal elements. So the determinant of the row echelon form of a matrix is going to be easy to compute, but the problem we have is the determinant of A does not equal the determinant of its row echelon form in general. So even though this determinant is easy to compute, it's just the product of the diagonal elements, it's not directly, well, at least at this stage, it's not directly related to the determinant of the original matrix. However, the next theorem says is that when you do the row operations, most of the times, the determinant of the matrix does not change, and the times when it does change are easy to understand. I got 4 minutes. I'll just be able to state what happens here. What happens is that when you start off with a matrix and you perform a single elementary row operation, well, the determinant does change. If you interchange rows, the determinant flips sign. If you replace a row by a scalar multiple of itself, well, that scalar factor is carried over into the new determinant. But here's the nice thing. Here's the row operation you perform all the time. You have a pivot below a pivot, so you use an upper row to cancel out the pivot in the lower row. You do this all the time, but this row operation does not change in the determinant. So the way we actually calculate a determinant of A is we row reduce it to row echelon form. Most of the time, the determinant is not going to change, but if we interchange two rows, I just have to remember that there's a sign flip involved. Or if I do a row rescaling, I just have to remember that my determinant has changed by the same factor. And so you can row reduce a matrix to row echelon form. All you have to do to get the corresponding determinant is remember how many times you've interchanged rows, and then you'll have as many factors of minus one from the determinant of the original matrix. Or if you've done any row rescalings, then you have to take into account those factors as well. But for the vast majority of your elementary row operations that you use as you row reduce your given matrix, it's not going to have any effect at all on the determinant. And so here's the formula. Suppose A row reduces to a matrix A prime in row echelon form. Then the determinant of the original matrix can be calculated in terms of the determinant of this matrix in row echelon form. Here's that determinant. Since it's in row echelon form, it's upper triangular, and so its determinant is just going to be the product of its diagonal elements. Easily computed. Now you have some correction factors. These factors of lambda, well, you have to remember how many times you've done row rescalings, and if you put a factor in doing a row rescaling, you're going to have to remove it. So you divide by it in the expression for the determinant. And then here, this minus one to the R, that's the number of times you flip rows in order to do the row reduction. But as long as you keep track of these sort of errors that were introduced as you did the row reduction, you can take them into account and you get a nice simple formula that once you get past the row reduction, all you have to do is multiply together the diagonal elements of your matrix in row echelon form, and then recall how many times you interchanged rows and how many times you rescaled rows. But you can get it very quickly that way. Okay, so let's see, 1 minute left. I don't even have time for an example today. So I'll let you go, and what we'll do on Monday is I'll do lots of examples of how you use row reduction to calculate determinants. Have a good weekend.